welcome everybody to the second episode of the Nets Pulse podcast on the Pulse Podcast Network. Thank you so much to our illustrious 40 listeners for joining. Your co-host, Brett the Man Bun Garofalo, sitting here with my esteemed friend and colleague, and when I say sitting here, I mean about 2,500 miles away from each other, Carl the Talent Jackson. Carl, how in God's name are you doing?
I'm hanging in there, Brett. You know, day to day, aren't we all? Still trying to find a little bit of meaning after the lackluster performance against the Chicago Bulls the other night. But, hopefully we bounce back and at least have a good showing against Toronto tomorrow.
I've got two words for you. Zebra muscles. I was distracted from the putrid performance against the Bulls by the smell of the water in Austin, Texas right now. Apparently, zebra mussels, due to people not cleaning the undersides of their boats, have infiltrated the pipes. The water smells like, as somebody described it, creamed dead fish. It is permeating our laundry, permeating our showers, permeating our food. It is disgusting. That's my personal anecdote for the day.
That's awesome. I can't help but hear the word zebra mussels and think of NFL referee Ed Hockley, but we can move along. We actually have them up here too. They're a menace. They, like, if you step on them, they will cut you up real bad. Not fun.
Oh God.
Anywho, so I think what we had talked about doing first was just a little trade deadline recap. We threw out a couple deals, possible deals last week, and obviously we know where the Nets landed at the end of the trade deadline. The one move being nabbing Greg Monroe or getting paid a second round pick to take Greg Monroe off of Toronto's balance sheet. I don't know if Greg Monroe got on a plane or not, but he did not land on the Brooklyn Nets roster. So, team is roughly where it was before, up one second round pick. So Brett, what I want to do is a little, it's kind of like a buy or sell or a, you know, do you feel better or worse kind of game here of think back to late January before Spencer Dinwiddie's thumb injury. But before we knew that LeVert was coming back, before the Brouxit, we didn't know about Anthony Davis. We didn't know about Porzingis shakeup. And you know, take yourself back to that time, think of everything that's transpired in the interim, and tell me, do you feel better or worse about the Nets' chances of making the playoffs this year?
My initial reaction, based purely on the trade deadline, was better. If you look at it at a high level, every team – outside of the top four in the East either got worse or remained stagnant while the top four teams loaded up. Oh man, this is going to be a fun playoffs. And even though the Nets stood pat, effectively they acquired a second round pick, we're improving by getting Caris LeVert back, Alan Crabb back, eventually getting Spencer Dinwiddie back, getting healthy for the stretch run. And two out of those three folks that I mentioned are two out of our three best players. And that's all happening within the next 4 to 5 weeks, presumably, if Spencer Dinwiddie's recovery goes as planned. Now, when you look at it as a whole, I think that I feel the exact same way about our chances to make the playoffs looking at our schedule. Because regardless of how healthy we are going down the stretch, our last 14 games are absolutely brutal. So that's presumably when we're going to be at full health with Dinwiddie back, LeVert hopefully playing himself back into shape, but we're going to be rounding into form for this terrible stretch run. I mean, starting on March 11th, we have 14 straight games of the Pistons, the Thunder, the Jazz, Clippers, Kings, Lakers, Blazers, Sixers, Boston, Bucks, Raptors, Bucks, Pacers, Heat. And that's to end the season. Presumably all of those teams will be fighting it out for playoff positioning. Very, very few of them will be resting their players. Maybe we'll get lucky at that point and seeding between the top four seeds will be determined. So Philadelphia, Boston, the Bucks, and Raptors will be wanting to rest their players. But that was the thing that made me 50-50 on our playoff shots, on our playoff shot as we started to play better this season. I don't think getting healthy and the teams around us staying stagnant or getting worse really affects that.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I mean, I think, you know, looking at the deadline itself, I think you have to be, you know, just purely from a myopic this season perspective, I think you have to be somewhat happy with the results because, you know, Charlotte tried and didn't land Marc Gasol. The Pistons made, you know, a lateral move with the Reggie Bullock trade. The Heat, you know, shed some salary, although I don't know how. I mean, they lost Tyler Johnson, but I don't know how much worse they got. So I don't really feel like any of the people that were competing for that spot and kind of the dark horse, you know, Washington got a lot worse. So I don't really know that any of the challengers for it got any better. So in that sense, I kind of agree with you. I do think the realities of the schedule and the realities of sort of some of the magic of the winning streak wearing off are a little bit more maybe sobering than changing the fortune. So I'll say I feel about the same as well. I feel cautiously sort of optimistic because I do think that if, you know, one of those teams had stocked up, also Indiana, I think, you know, is another candidate to kind of fall out of the picture. So I'll say I feel about the same kind of cautiously optimistic that the Nets squeak in. One thing that I don't feel the same on, but I'll let you answer the question, is how do you feel on the Nets' chances of winning a playoff series in 2019?
I only feel good about it if by some act of God, the stars, moons, and quasars align, and we end up playing the Indiana Pacers in the first round, which if somehow we end up with the sixth seed, the Pacers are playing well. They are a team that they had a Wes Matthews buyout, which I think will actually help them. They need more shooting. They need more playmaking with Oladipo out. They could theoretically hold on to that third seed with Boston struggling a little bit and some of the other teams, like the Sixers, potentially resting players down the stretch if the Raptors and the Bucks really start to run away with this thing. But outside of that, much worse. The top four teams loaded up. It is going to be so much fun to watch which one of these teams earns the right to lose to the Golden State Warriors in the finals. And I don't mean that sarcastically. I'm going to have a blast, even though the end of the NBA season is all but a foregone conclusion at this point.
Do you feel like any of these teams could challenge them?
The Sixers looked very good today against the Lakers. They put up 143 points. Jimmy Butler looked like he wasn't even trying out there, saving himself for the playoffs. I think he took a total of 10 shots. So if they really play up to their talent level, I think they're the one team that could really challenge the Warriors because they have players that are incredibly unique. The Warriors aren't really equipped to guard. There's no way Boogie Cousins is going to be able to stay with and defend Embiid. And who the heck guards Ben Simmons on that team? Even Draymond won't be able to stay with him. And I know there's been a lot said about their bench, but I do think that their bench, if they can find a ball handler in the buyout market, is going to end up being pretty solid. Boban's a pretty solid player. Jonathan Simmons can at least defend. I think that they're the one team that can really, if they reach their ceiling, challenge the Warriors.
Yeah, I do too. And I think you bring up a good point there with like Embiid just being the type of player that I think most teams in this league, probably up to and including the Nets, aren't really equipped to guard right now. And I think that, you know, Tobias Harris, I mean, obviously, you know, part of what makes him who he is and makes him good is the fact that he is kind of this plug and play option at the four. So it's sort of unsurprising that he's been so good so quickly, but man, has he been really good really quickly. And, you know, man, is it hard to not think a little bit about whether or not, you know, we would have had the ability, to pry him, away from the Clippers. I mean, I don't really look at any of the deals. I mean, we talked a little bit about Harris and we talked a little bit about, Mirotić. As you know, possible targets. I don't really look at any of the deals that went down and feel like, wow, Sean Marks really should have gotten involved in that, just given the prices that were being thrown around. Was that roughly how you felt, or did you feel differently?
I feel exactly the same way. To me, those are the type of deals you make if you already feel like you have a shot to win the championship and you want to load up before a playoff run. You at that point, it's okay to give up assets, because giving up those assets and mortgaging a bit of the future is worth it for a legitimate shot to win a championship. We're just not in that position right now, and we would have undermined not all of, but a lot of the hard work that Sean Marks has done to put us in a position to not only have cap space, but assets, which are two things that the Nets haven't had at the same time. And man, I can't even remember the last time.
It's been a while. It's been a while. So I guess, like, you know, just thinking about what we talked about last time, I mean, part of the reason that both of those trades made sense was, you know, the opportunity to bring a guy in like Tobias Harris, who you might want to target in the offseason, or bring Mirotić in, who you might want to target in the offseason to either get their bird rights or at least just have the additional 3 months to kind of recruit them and you know, get people excited around a playoff chase. Given the way that everything kind of shook out over the deadline with those guys and with some other players, do you feel better or worse about the Nets' chance? I'm going to kind of phrase this question two different ways. So do you feel better or worse about the Nets' chances of landing a max free agent this summer? And then do you feel better or worse about their chances of making a meaningful upgrade through free agency this summer, whether or not it's the max?
I'm going to say better, but solely because of what Zach Lowe said in his podcast the other day. He verbatim said, watch out for Brooklyn, who has caught the attention of agents and players with their culture and development. Now, we've been hearing that all season, but to hear it from somebody that's plugged into the league, that talks to a lot of executives and coaching staffs, that made me feel a lot better. And that was after a lot of the moves had gone down at the deadline, including the Greg Monroe trade. So showing that Brooklyn wasn't going all in. We weren't one of these teams like the Raptors and the Sixers that were loading up for a run, but still free agents were interested in coming to Brooklyn. Now, do I think it's going to happen if I had to bet on it? No, but do I feel better about my chances after the deadline than I did before? Yes. Now, additionally, if there is a guide and we do land a franchise-altering free agent or two this summer, the talks between the Grizzlies and the Nets on, I believe the trade was Allen Crabbe plus the Nuggets pick for Jamichael Green and Derek Temple before the Grizzlies ultimately decided to go in a different direction and pick up Avery Bradley for that same package, makes me fairly confident that if we do end up signing a few folks, we'll be able to adequately dump Crabbe's contract without significantly hamstringing any of our future assets and our ability to build around those assets moving forward. So all in all, I do feel better about it. But as far as making a meaningful upgrade through free agency this summer, I think our four spot right now is so bad that any upgrade there would be meaningful. So I feel better about that piece as well.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you and I were talking about, you know, Crabbe and him coming back, and he's definitely somebody that, you know, I've frankly been excited about watching play the past couple of days, because, you know, he's been such a streaky player for us, but when he can shoot, you know, he is an actual asset out there on the floor. I mean, he's not maybe worth what he's getting paid, but that doesn't mean that he's not an upgrade over, you know, what's available below him on the bench. Okay. So last question that I wanted to ask you is, you know, given everything that's gone down with Porzingis, given all that we've heard around kind of Anthony Davis, the Durant press conference where he called out Ethan Strauss about, you know, bringing up his free agency, all the tea leaf reading from Kyrie, what do you feel better or worse about the Nets' chances of being the best team in New York in 2019-2020? And then how about 2024-25, like 5 years down the line? So next year or 5 years down the line?
Grow up, Carl. Grow up, all right? Listen, all I do is I show up to this podcast episode after episode trying to bring my best, and you're out here asking me about how the Nets are going to look in 2024 when we finally have our first round draft pick in the first year since 1907. Grow up.
Yo, we have a first round draft pick this year. Oh, I see what you're saying. Why am I asking you that? Well, I'm saying, you know, a little bit like, does the, you know, it's sort of like how quickly do you rebound if the current trajectory fails? But I think it's a valid question, Brett. I'm a grown ass man, so thank you very much.
I'm sorry that I insulted your pride. I guess my gut reaction to your question, and I want so badly to believe that we're going to be a better team than the Knicks after this summer, but it's so hard for me to fathom that they would make moves like they did without knowing something, without knowing that at least one free agent is heavily leaning towards coming to New York and being the man. And I believe that free agent is Kevin Durant. And if he comes, I think he's going to be able to draw at least one more max-level player, whether it's somebody with true superstar talent like a Kyrie Irving or a Kawhi Leonard, that remains to be seen. But I really, really could see them pulling in two max free agents this summer. I know that history doesn't tells us otherwise, but it's tough for me to imagine that they could possibly be this dumb. Now,
yeah, I mean,
go ahead.
I don't think they're. I mean, I think, you know, looking at the, you know, the way that they're getting run and their relationships, you know, like from the Seattle days that Perry has with Kevin Durant. Like, I mean, I'm sure that they feel that that's the case, and I'm sure that they've been given every indication that that's the case. I don't know that you could have asked for a promise from a more mercurial individual than Kevin Durant, except for maybe Kyrie Irving, who's the other person that's coming in. So that, you know, that's where kind of the sands are a little bit shifty underneath. I do think that the Porzingis deal, the more I think about it, was a smart move for them because it gives them the assets of Dallas's two first round picks, where, you know, they can kind of hedge against if nobody does show up, build an additional core, or, you know, if somebody does have assets to get better quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the best thing that ever happened to the Knicks was Draymond Green yelling at Kevin Durant in plain sight, "We won before you got here. To leave. We don't need you." The writing wasn't on the wall then, it is now.
Yeah, no, that is fair. That is very fair.
Now for 2024-25, I wouldn't say that I'm a pessimist. I try to be a realist about the Nets. I feel better about our chances. I would say by all accounts, talent and assets wise, the Knicks are currently and have been ahead of us due to Sean Marks having to crawl out from under the immense weight of the Pierce Garnett trade, having zero assets to trade or zero players to trade for picks and zero picks. But this deadline once again has solidified my mind that he's not going to sacrifice the short term for the long term just to boost ticket sales. And that to me is the thing that makes me feel the best about the Nets' future, and the fact that we're going to make better decisions than the Knicks over a stretch of 5 years, regardless of what shakes out this summer, to put us in a better position to win. Like, for example, you and I just talked about this. Did we have the assets to put together a package to get a stretch four like Tobias Harris or Mirotic that would have all but ensured a playoff spot this season, especially considering that what we talked about earlier, all these teams around us competing for the 6, 7, 8 seeds remain stagnant or potentially even got worse when you look at a team like Detroit? 100% we did, but that's not our goal, and the actions that Sean Marks takes continues to emphasize to the fans that having one decent Cinderella season just to sell tickets and boost TV ratings isn't what the Nets are about. We're about sustainable long-term culture. We want to be a true contender. We're not simply a money-printing machine. And so that is why I feel a little bit better about our chances to be a contender or a stronger team in a better position than the Knicks in 2025.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, and you and I have talked about it a lot, and we'll get into it maybe a little bit as if we want to keep talking stretch four here. But, you know, I think that a lot of times things get a little bit like oversimplified just on a macro level from a basketball standpoint of like looking at teams are either tanking or trying to make the playoffs. And I think that, you know, the Nets are kind of in a slightly different position where playing hard, being competitive. There's no question they're trying to make the playoffs this year, but I don't think they need to make the playoffs this year, right? So, I mean, I think, you know, if they try hard, compete, come up short, and, you know, end up in the lottery, that's probably okay. Like, obviously, it would be a negative that they fell short of the goal that they'd set for themselves. But it puts them in a little bit of a different position when you look at something like this, as opposed to somebody like Charlotte, who's, like, absolutely trying to do everything that they can to make the playoffs, regardless of what it means going forward. The Nets are more trying to make the playoffs as a byproduct of putting a competitive team out there and letting guys that are future assets like D'Angelo Russell or Spencer Dinwiddie or Rodion Skoruk or, you know, other guys on the team, like, learn and grow and continue to compete and become better players.
Right. And I think it's also indicative that Cy and Prokhorov aren't putting the wrong type of pressure on Marks too, because if they were saying, hey, you're going to lose your job or these are goals that you have to meet, we'd see him making different moves. And on top of that, I am confident that if and when we're in a position like a Toronto or a Philadelphia to really make a run at this thing, that they're going to give the green light to spend money. I mean, I don't know if everybody remembers, but Prokhorov lost $144 million of his own money on a mediocre Nets team in 2014. Now, did he or a lot of the fans believe we were going to be mediocre that year? No. But at the end of that season, that ended in disappointment and heartbreak, when reporters asked him what it was like to lose $104 million, he said, it's no big deal. So just imagine what him and Cy are going to do collectively if we actually have a shot to make a run at a title. That makes me feel really, really hopeful about the future.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and I think that it seems like they've certainly pivoted their strategy from make as big a splash as possible to let's do what we can to sort of slowly and patiently build a winning team that has a foundation that'll last for a while. And that's a pretty exciting thing, because as we've seen in so many other markets and so many other teams, like, ownership is absolutely a crucial piece of the team building puzzle.
Yeah. And the stats back up that what we're doing is working too. I don't know if you saw the viewership ratings recently. Now, the Nets are still far and away last in the league in attendance and far behind the Knicks when it comes to TV ratings. But just looking at the microcosm of this year and the sample size of this year, Nets on YES viewership is up 9% compared to this exact point in time last season. Now, on the flip side of that, at this point in the time last season, Knicks viewership is down 44%. So we're not breaking the bank and we're trending in the right direction. That has got to be something that ownership is incredibly happy with.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I hope I'm not eating these words come summer, Carl. Just let me have this.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. It's always a gambit. And I'm sure, like, you know, once, I mean, I say it right now that, like, you know, I'd love to root against Kevin Durant if he was in a Knicks uniform. And, you know, the best thing for the Nets would be if the Knicks were really good and you know, the two, you know, really got to go at it on a year in, year out basis. But, oh boy, is that the prospect of just getting pushed around by them is a little bit terrifying as well.
Nothing would be better than beating Durant. But if we don't get a superstar and they do, it's tough for me to fathom that we're going to be truly competing with the Knicks over the next few seasons. Now, I do have to say one more point on the trade deadline from a Nets fan perspective. I take personal offense to the fans out there claiming that Brooklyn gave up nothing for that second round pick from Toronto. Guys, we had to void Mitch Creek's 10-day contract. Mitch Creek, all right?
That is true. That's a bummer.
I'm inconsolably devastated as a official member of Mitch's crew per my visit in San Antonio.
Yeah, man. I was gonna say, damn. And don't forget, don't sleep on cash considerations either.
I think the Trailblazers Twitter account tweeted out a picture of a player in place of its head. It had a bag of money.
Yeah no, it was like the Geico money thing with eyeballs, but yes, indeed.
Anything else you wanted to share on the trade deadline from the Nets perspective?
No, I mean, I think that pretty much wraps it up.
Cool. And in my opinion, I don't mind game-by-game recaps, but for me, especially with how emotionally invested I get in the Nets and every possession when I'm watching, if I'm doing a game-by-game recap, that really tends to foster overreactions. let me just put it that way. So I think instead it's healthier for me and probably for a lot of Nets fans to review trends over a handful of games and share some anecdotes and things that we're seeing. And that fits the Nets motif, in my opinion, as we've been talking about in this podcast. It's about the long-term rebuilding project and looking into the future. So overreacting to individual games like that god-awful Zebra Muscles Bulls loss is the farthest thing from healthy for my heart. And I feel like we're all just out here trying not to die of heart attacks before we're 40.
Yeah, and you probably didn't need my overzealous take after the Nuggets win, where I thought that the Nets were probably the best team in the league, and I didn't understand how anybody could beat them ever because they're just going to shoot whatever 60% or whatever they shot from three every game. I don't see why that doesn't happen more often.
After that game,
we should do that.
We should just do that every game.
Yeah.
If you weren't convinced that Trevion Graham is the best player in the league after that game, then you're not a true Nets fan.
So, you know, it's funny, not to jump into our next topic here, but I was running a bunch of numbers on the four spot of the lineup, just using five-man lineup data from PvP stats. And obviously the sample is completely skewed because most of Graham's playing time has come like during this 10-game hot streak. But by far the best numbers of anybody at the four have come from Trevion Graham, like by a country mile. Like, he's 10 points better per 100 possessions than the next best offensive rating team, offensive rating unit, and plus 42 in 183 minutes. Almost none of the other lineups that have played over like 15 minutes are in the positive.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's worth something. It's a little bit small sample size theater there, I think, but it's interesting.
I mean, the Nuggets game goes to show that if we can go small, we should go small. And this leads me to the segment where I get to ask Carl a question, so I'm excited to turn the tables here. But the first topic that we wanted to cover is, and Carl, you dipped into it a little bit, but do you think that the Nets fan base is oversimplifying our plea to upgrade the four?
So, you know, I kind of came into this thinking that my answer was going to be yes, that it was getting oversimplified. But the more I kind of look at it, the only piece that I don't necessarily think is correct is like it just looking at the way that Kenny Atkinson puts his lineups together, right? You know, it is much more like a just deep rotation and guys kind of play where they play. And so even when I was trying to parse out like who the individual like fours were in a given lineup, like the best way I could come up to do it was basically just ranking guys on a continuum from like Shabazz Napier as like, whenever he's on the floor, he's going to be the nominal point guard, because even if he's on with Dinwiddie or Russell or LeVert, like he's, you know, in the point guard role, he's probably guarding the point guard, like all the way through Ed Davis, who's like always a center. And if he and Allen ever shared time, he would be the center. And like kind of anybody and everything in between is just sort of on a complete sliding scale. So it's not necessarily that it's a four per se, but I do think, you know, given kind of the what we have from a guard perspective with Dinwiddie, Russell, LeVert, and then getting into kind of whatever you call kind of like your sort of small to medium sized wings with Harris, Crabbe, you know, and then, you know, getting into your medium to larger wings with Damari Carroll and Rondé and, you know, like Jared Dudley and Kurucs, like being more of a true stretch four. Like, there's just one clear spot in that sort of whole continuum that can get upgraded. And it's looking at the minutes that have been given to guys at the four. I mean, you've got 767 minutes played there by Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, almost the same amount by Rodion Skoruks. Jared Dudley at you know, nearly 700 minutes, and then, you know, pretty steep drop off after that. But if you feel like that trio, and then Trevion Graham kind of coming in here later, who, you know, positive stats aside, I think we can both agree isn't really the long-term answer there, then, you know, that's clearly the place that, that an upgrade needs to happen. I think, you know, clearly somebody that can space the floor, somebody who can make plays off the dribble, and somebody who can, I think, help slide Kurucs around a little bit too, so that he's not having to play all of his minutes against the first team, and he's able to do a little bit more, I think, in a bench context or a different context would be good for his growth.
I'm really glad that you brought up this Trevion Graham at the four thing, because I do think that has legs with his intelligence, activity, and strength on defense. But like you said, that's neither a long-term solution or one that's even viable in over 7 to 10 minutes a game. But off of the bench, to change it up a little bit, I think that's a lineup that we need to pursue more if that's not getting more minutes. And I think the biggest reason that this is on Nets fans' minds is because of the casual eye test. If you watch the games, who plays the most four for us or seems to play the most four for us or is our most prominent four, longest tenured member of the Nets, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson. And man, even if that guy is playing well, his game is really, really tough to watch. And I've got another question for you. What do Quincy Pondexter and Domantas Sabonis have in common?
They both went to college in Washington State.
Your mom went to college.
she did.
She did. These are the two players listed at either small forward or power forward on ESPN.com that have played a minimum of 40 games and made less overall threes than Rondae Hollis-Jefferson this season. That's it. Pondexter and Sabonis, it's brutal. Now, I did cheat a little bit and eliminate guys like Mason Plumlee, Enes Kanter, and Montrezl Harrell, because those guys should not be listed as power forwards for any reason. I probably should have used a different site, noticing that those positional rankings were way off, but that was brutal. He's made 9 on the season. And to top that off, Rodion's Kurucs, who could be a viable solution at the four given his skill set, hasn't hit a three since 2018. So it's been tough to watch shooting-wise with both of those guys.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Rodion's, like, you know, obviously he kind of showed a lot more than was expected of him early on. I think, you know, his shot is it looks mechanically okay. Like, you know, I don't think it's terrible or anything, but like, obviously that's something that's going to come, you know, as he gains more experience in the league. I think I've been most impressed with him in terms of just like putting the ball on the floor and getting to the rack and being able to make plays, honestly, which has been fantastic. But again, like, I think it's doing a disservice to him and to his development to slot him into like the starting lineup in the way that he has been. And then he and Rondé are like almost completely redundant in terms of skill set, because what skill set Rondé has is more about cutting and kind of getting open and getting to the basket. But, I think as I've watched him, and listen, I've rooted for him for, you know, as long as he's been on the Nets, I think he's, you know, a great hustle player. I'm sure that there's a situation that he could contribute in, but like really his only value to this team right now is minimizing, you know, defects that you might have in your lineup. It's basically like he can plug in at so many different positions that, you know, you can pull him in as a plus defender when somebody's out at like literally any position. And that's it. But there's just no version, I don't think, of a good team that he's playing on, because replacing his minutes with somebody who is, you know, essentially a replacement level NBA player is necessary if you want to be a good team.
It's tough. I truly feel like his value is going to be spot defense off the bench in pressure situations. Throw him in at the end of games when you need to smother another team, let him shut somebody down, and then put him back on the bench. Now, is there room on a 15-man roster for a player like that? Probably not, especially for what he's going to want to get paid. But if he wants to stay in the league, that's probably where he needs to go. I know there's a lot of videos online of him shutting people down in the last 2 minutes of games. And if you don't have to have him out there on offense, that does have value in terms of switchability, because there are typically well-crafted plays being run by folks like Brad Stevens at the end of games, where you need to know that whoever a guy like Rondé gets switched on, he's going to be able to do a serviceable job guarding. So I think there might be some value there. What I will say, though, is when we're talking about a lot of the fours that fans have called for, when you look at Harris or Mirotić, all of them have been offensive-minded players who, at their very best, in a case like Harris, aren't net negatives on defense. And when you look into the stats for the Nets, they're ranked 17th in both offensive and defensive rating. So we need help on both sides of the ball. And looking at the fours that are going to be available come this summer moving forward, there don't seem to be too many that truly help out on both sides of the ball. So I'm very interested to see how much of an impact that really does make on our team. Shooting always helps, especially in the way that offenses are played nowadays. But it looks to me like we're probably going to pursue an offensive four, mainly because it seems like Kenny continuously puts out lineups that punt defense for offense, like we did in the Nuggets game, which is why they almost came back by putting in 36 points in about 36 seconds in the last 3 minutes of that game. But that's what's been working for us, and that's what seems to be available. Now, that being said, here's a wild scenario. One of the buyout candidates that's still out there is Michael Beasley. He's a terrible culture guy, but if that's really the theory that management has, that having somebody offensive-minded at the four spot would help out this team, why not pick him up for the stretch run and see what he does in some of those lineups, being able to hit shots and being somebody that's going to have a little bit of gravity on the offensive side? I don't think it's going to happen, but why not?
Yeah, I guess another way to phrase that to you is, like, do you value that more than just getting Jared Dudley back? I don't necessarily know that there's, like, an opportunity to, like, uncover, like, that Michael Beasley is, like, secretly a really, you know, effective player that is going to help us out a ton next year. I mean, I suppose that could be one scenario where that would be a positive, but if it's just pulling him in, I mean, I guess it couldn't hurt to have both of them, but I do feel like, you know, if you're getting Dudley back and he's bringing some of that, then I'm not sure it's necessary.
I was more thinking from somebody that could create their own shot off the dribble. And I wasn't even thinking of, hey, maybe we find a diamond in the rough and sign him for next year. I think I was thinking of it more as an experiment to see, oh, this is how much better the team could be with somebody that wasn't a crafty drive once or twice a game. If somebody's off balance, hit a couple open threes like Dudley, veteran, versus somebody that can take someone off the dribble, hit a couple of turnarounds and hit open threes. How much does that truly affect the offense with no thoughts of signing Michael Beasley and making him part of our culture moving forward?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the other thing would be if you could somehow, like, slice and dice and fuse, you know, Trevion Graham's, like, I don't even know if Graham's shot's better than Karuk's shot, honestly, but ostensibly if you could shoot like Trevion Graham's offensive reputation, you could get to the basket like Rodion's Karuk's, and you could defend like Rondé, then I think we'd be in business.
What is the over under on how many threes Kenny and the assistant coaches make Rodion's Karuk's shoot this offseason?
So there was a class at Kenyon called Surprises at Infinity. And I'm not sure what that number is, but it's damn close to infinity. I mean, if his arms don't fall off by August 1st, then there's a problem. Like that kid needs to just be shooting all day, every day, all summer.
It's going to be such a game changer for him if he ever figures out how to shoot the three consistently, and especially if he figures out how to shoot the three off of the dribble as well, because he's already shown the sneaky, potentially slightly better than Joe Harris-esque ability to get to the rim off the dribble from beyond the three-point arc when defenders are respecting his shot, and even dunk the ball, let alone get fouled or hit a layup. If he starts creating some gravity, it will really open up his game, and he truly could end up being our Manu Ginobili-esque second round pick. I don't think he's going to ever be as good as Manu, but he could be known as that player for us and a cornerstone of what people talk about when they talk about the Nets, Sean Marks, Kenny Atkinson, our ability to evaluate talent. Now, that timeline is probably way too long for our and the Nets' liking, but hey, a girl can dream.
Absolutely. I mean, listen, we're all on the Rodian's dream boat right now.
I'm out here for that, Bam. Now you talked about Alan Crabb earlier, and I also am not a Crabb hater. And like you said, he's looked surprisingly spry since returning from injury, posting back-to-back lines of over 10 points and shooting over 50% from the field, and most importantly, from three. Do you think all of the negativity that Nets fans have had since we traded for Alan Crabb has been warranted?
I don't, and I think, you know, for a couple reasons. Like, one, I think that I'm really sort of sensitive to guys who become kind of like punchlines in some way, and it sort of becomes this like common knowledge, and I feel like that's, he's always been sort of the butt paragraph in any story about Sean Marks and Kenny Atkinson, in terms of, you know, everything's worked out really well except for the Crabb deal. And I think, like, you have to consider a couple things. Like, number one, I think Marks gets sort of maligned for offering the contract that he ended up signing in restricted free agency and then trading for him, which, like, I agree, like, was not necessarily that smart of a move. And I don't think that, you know, it should be looked at as a positive move. But I do think that if you think about where they were at that point, and really the only asset that they had to work with was cap flexibility, like, I think it was an acceptable move given that they were willing to kind of increase the risk that they were willing to take on. I mean, I feel like since Crabb's gotten here, I'm pretty underwhelming, at least during his first season. He goes on these hot streak kind of tears where, you know, he looks, you sort of understand where everything came from, and then has just kind of failed to put it together. He's definitely struggled with injuries. So, I mean, you know, my view of him is like definitely not somebody that I'm counting on, not something that I'm looking at for like next season or anything and being like, okay, Alan Crabb's going to be a big part of this team. But at the same time, like, I feel like everybody's like, you know, so concerned about getting off of his money for next year. And like, if there's a good reason for doing that, then sure, by all means. But I don't feel like his money is preventing us from doing anything or standing in the way of any kind of bigger move. I think it's far more likely that if that move doesn't happen, it'll just be because it wasn't available. And if that move's not available and that money's not getting used for anything else, then, you know, fine, let it be used for Crabb. There's only one more year left on that deal. So it's not like it's a franchise killer or anything.
Only one more year left, and the talks at the Grizzlies prove that it shouldn't be that hard to move if we need to, because he is somebody that can add value to a team for the duration of his contract. Now, I'm going to say that I, for one, cannot be more excited to watch Allen post-All-Star break Crabb start hitting 7 threes a game like he's done these past two seasons. Now, I don't know if it's going to be different this year when the pressure is off, because we're going to need him down this stretch run, but hell, I remember we had a couple 30-point games and was the Nets' best player on the floor down the stretch these past 2 years. And if that happens, especially in those last 14 games, and we're going to be playing against all those teams vying for playoff slots, watch out, because that's going to be really, really fun.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like when you look at the team, and we were talking a little bit about the box scores, like, you know, particularly with Dinwiddie out, because I think he acts like a good stabilizing force for the offense, it really comes down to who's hitting threes. And on nights when, you know, D'Angelo is okay or doesn't quite have it going, like, having somebody else be able to step up and start knocking shots down, whether it's Trevion Graham or Crabb or whomever, is really important. So having somebody that's reasonably, you know, under consideration to do that, I think is helpful.
Exactly. And not only now that it's going to be super helpful down the stretch in while we're making our first ever playoffs run of the Marks era, but I truly believe that we threw contracts at folks like Crabb and Porter because Sean Marks and Kenny Atkinson saw them as essential to the development of our young guys like Caris LeVert, D'Angelo Russell, and Spencer Dinwiddie, are driving kickers, because it's much tougher to run the style of offense, drive and kick, that Kenny wants to run or create as an individual without floor spacers like Alan Crabb that draw defenders with their gravity. Now, like you said earlier, to be overpaying, absolutely. Does that mean he's not valuable to this team? Absolutely not. I think that's why we went after him. And
I think there's reason to overpay him at the time. I mean, when all you have is money and you're not spending it on anybody else, that's the time to overpay somebody.
Yeah. And how about two other Sean Marks poison pill contracts getting dumped for not equal value at this deadline? Otto Porter and Tyler Johnson, baby. See you later.
Woo! Yeah, and then Porter came and kicked our shorts.
Yeah,
but whatever.
He was great on that team. Oh, God. But for real, if we strike out this summer and there's no reason to dump Crabbe's contract, I could see a very likely scenario where he comes back 2019-20, ends up being his best season with us and ever, because number one, it's a contract year, and number two, the pressure's off to remain with the team. And then because he likes the culture, because we were the team that believed in him and gave us that money, maybe he agrees to sign for significantly cheaper than he's making now moving forward, because he is a player that would help this team, or really any team, due to his shooting and his ability, his length, and his the effort that he puts in on defense.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's fair. I'm already getting a little bit of the willies thinking about signing Alan Crabbe to another contract, but if it comes at enough of a discount, I think it makes sense. And I think, you know, I think the way I look at Crabbe is like, listen, I would absolutely love to have a reason to get rid of his contract, but until I have one, you know, he's fine.
There you have it. Carl Jackson incredibly excited about the future of Alan Crabbe with the Brooklyn Nets. Hope for the best, prepare for the worst.
Exactly.
I think you pointed out that he did waive his trade kicker when he came to the Nets.
I read that. I did not. I said I was going to find the source on that, and I didn't do it. So I'll look it up, and we can bring it up next episode. Just like I'll bring up that you never vented me $50 for the last one. But,
oh, God, I do owe anyway. You that $50. You nailed that. On the first three, too.
On to the next topic.
Do anything else that you want to add about Crabbe or the four spot?
No. I think we got him covered.
Okay. Well, Carl, I wanted to end the show with a special treat for you, as you joined the collective Nets fan base with our move to Brooklyn when you lived two blocks from the Barclays Center. So I thought it would be really fun to share some pre-Brooklyn Nets facts each week or each episode with you. Now, this week's ends up being something that I didn't know, and this is going to help carry on the lore and tradition of our New Jersey roots. So I think we're going to call this segment Go Swamp Dragons, baby. Said that my dream is to one day have a custom-made Brook Lopez Swamp Dragons jersey and get it signed by the legend himself. We need to give him a Paul Pierce-esque 10-day contract at the end of his career and have him retire as a Net. And also, if Robin Lopez doesn't get bought out by the Bulls so that he can go play with his brother for the first time in their professional careers, I will be beside myself.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool. That would be pretty special.
Anyway, I'm going to start this session with a question, because after that, it's going to be a lot of me talking, which might get boring for you, but I promise you this is going to be worth it. But let's start off with a very harmless, innocuous question here. Carl, what was the year that the Brooklyn Nets franchise broke ground and played its first ever professional basketball game?
1973.
Very close. It was the 1967-68 season, which was also...
You know, I was going to say 67, but whatever. I didn't.
Well, don't worry. I didn't put the $50 on the line, so I still owe you that. But that was also the first season for the great ABA. We were then known as the New Jersey Americans, but this was our only season under that name. We would rebrand as the New Jersey Nets before the start of the following year. In our first inaugural season, believe it or not, the New Jersey Americans made the playoffs. So we ended the regular season tied for fourth out of the 11 illustrious teams that were part of the ABA at the time, tied for fourth with the Kentucky Colonels. The Colonels.
It's a good name.
Coached by Mr. Sanders. So it was pretty run-of-the-mill, straightforward stuff so far. Now, here's where it gets a little bit fun. So we played all of our games at the Teaneck Armory on Long Island. And that was where we booked the tiebreaker to get into the playoffs and get that fourth and final spot. Well, there was something already booked. So, okay, no big deal. We'll find another arena. We're going to move the game to the Comac Long Island Arena, which would be the future home of the Nets once we rebranded. But wait, in true Nets fashion, this arena was deemed, and I quote, unsuitable for a professional basketball game. Okay, no big deal. There's got to be another arena on Long Island that the Nets can play in. Actually, nope. Let's just give up. Let's just not play the game and force the Americans to forfeit, give the playoff spot to the Kentucky Colonels. That is the most Nets beginning I can possibly imagine for this franchise.
Make the playoffs. Try to find a second home for it because, you know, something else was scheduled during it. And essentially be forced to forfeit because your second building was not habitable for a playoff game or in a basketball game of any kind.
And give up trying to find a third arena.
Yeah, because that you're only in the most densely populated metropolitan area in the entire country. So, you know, it's got to be difficult to find somewhere to play.
So I'd like to dedicate this episode to the Comac Long Island Arena janitorial staff. Thanks, gents. now that wasn't the fun part. This is the fun part to me, and this is something that, and this is a basketball story that I'll be telling for a while, and I'm so glad that I went down this rabbit hole. But that season, the Americans were led by legendary, and this is true, this isn't sarcastic, legendary Brooklyn native Tony Jackson. Jackson was our lone all-star for the season, and he had come over from the little known ABL, or American Basketball League, which I've never heard of. But this guy in the ABL set the record for three-pointers in a game with 12. He was a 6'4 small forward, and this is the only season he would play for the Nets. Now, in that season, he was an all-star, like I said, and set the record for free throws in the game with 24 and was part of being screwed out of the playoffs by the Comac Long Island Arena. Now, here's where this part gets fun. Why the heck was this guy that could hit 12 three-pointers in the game, an all-star, and go to the line 12 times in an ABA game, not in the NBA? Well, it turns out that he was part of a 1962 point-shaving scandal with Connie Hawkins, Doug Moe, and Roger Brown. He was banned from professional basketball for life. That was our all-star. So he was relegated to joining the ABL. Again, never heard of this thing. Why? It lasted only a season and a half. But from what I found then, I thought this was the ABA, but I guess not. The ABL was the first league to introduce both the three-point shot and a wider fouling, expanding it from 12 to 18 feet. So those are both fundamental institutions of the modern-day NBA. So why the heck did the ABL fold? And again, you can't make this stuff up. George Steinbrenner. So Steinbrenner was part owner of one of their franchises, the Cleveland Pipers. During the first season of the ABL, he made a backhanded secret deal with the NBA franchise Kansas City Steelers to merge with them and join the NBA as long as he was able to sign All-Star Jerry Lucas. Now, the ABL found out about this, legally blocked the move, left Steinbrenner and the Pipers as a franchise without a league, and instead of rejoining the ABL, Steinbrenner got pissed, picked up his toys, and left the sandbox, opting to fold the Pipers instead. So that ended up kicking off a series of events where they moved franchises all around the country and caused the ABL to financially fold halfway through the second season. You can't make this stuff up. We think basketball has drama. Now imagine if this stuff was happening. I mean, the 60s and 70s were legitimately the wild, wild west. Now, the last thing that I'll leave you with here is the only reason the ABL became a thing was because the then owner of the Harlem Globetrotters said that he was promised an NBA franchise for continuing to maintain the Globetrotters for 5 to 10 years. When he didn't get one, he got angry and created the ABL to compete with the NBA out of spite. It was a league of spite. Harlem Globetrotters, George Steinbrenner, Steph Curry.
It's a lot to take in there, Brett.
I'm sorry, that was a lot of talking, but when I went down this rabbit hole, I got more and more excited by what I was reading.
No, I mean, it sounds pretty awesome. And it definitely, like, you know, you bring up a good point about the drama now, because if you compare it to, like, shenanigans that I've heard from the ABA, it's a lot different. I mean, not even the Gilbert Arenas, Javaris Crittenden, poker shootout even comes close to matching some of the ABA stuff. So it's pretty wild.
Really wild. I also, fun game for you. Which one of the following names isn't the name of a 1967-68 ABA New Jersey Americans professional basketball player? Ready? A, Al Beard. B, Johnny Austin. C, Slick Watts. D, Laverne Tart. E, Stu Johnson. It took everything in my power not to laugh while I was saying those names.
I'm going to go with Stu Johnson.
Incorrect. That was a real ABA player.
Slick Watts is, like, too late for that, right?
Yeah, Slick Watts was too late. So Slick was a Sonics player from the 70s, and he, when I found out, he became famous for becoming the first professional basketball player to ever shave his head, and that's why he earned the nickname Slick.
Nice.
So I'm sorry, that was a lot to take in. I hope everybody stayed with us through that story and found it as enjoyable as I did, because I just kept going from Wikipedia page to Wikipedia page, finding out about the ABL, having my hopes and dreams shattered that the ABA was not the first league to create the three-point line, finding out that our first Nets season makes perfect sense when you take into context the entire history of the Nets. It was a ton of fun.
And then we got to, you know, talk a little bit about my man Brunswick Stu Johnson. So might as well put a bow on it.
Good old Brunny Stu. Well, I think we should probably wrap it up. What do you think?
I think so. Who do you like tomorrow? Nets, Raptors. What do you think?
Oh, God. I mean, you know what I'm going to say. Unless we find some sort of magical small lineup, which I don't think we're going to find against the Raptors, because they can throw every possible lineup out there, unless Nick Nurse treats this as one of those games where he really doesn't care if they win or blow the team out. He wants to see how Marc Gasol is going to integrate with other players. That, I think, is our only hope. But if I was a betting man, I would take the Raptors and take the over, and I don't even know what the spread is.
I hope we at least have a Spurs-like loss. Like when we lost to the Spurs and, you know, hung in there. That's my main hope. I hope we don't just, you know, crap our diaper like we did against the Bulls. But, you know, maybe we'll also, you know, shoot 75% from three and just scorch the earth on him. We've done that as well. Who knows?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, if we're going to lose like we did in the Spurs game, you want to see growth from the players, and that's what keeps it interesting. And Joe Harris made some great plays down the stretch there, and Shabazz didn't play well and then came back and absolutely destroyed it in that Nuggets game by distributing the ball. So as long as the players continue to learn from games like that, I'm good. But can we please, please, please just split these last two games before the All-Star break and rest up, please?
I don't have a problem with that.
We should throw that out there. Also, actually, before we wrap up, I don't want to do this every time, but I have to wish a happy 50th birthday. That's right, 50th to Ian Eagle. One of the sole reasons the Nets have remained slightly watchable these past 4 to 5 seasons. And for the love of all that is good and holy, can we please, please let this man call the Super Bowl already? Throw him and Romo in there. Let him loose. There would be no better combination than that. Look how great he is with Richard Jefferson. I'm not a Nance hater. I just know how much better it could be.
Absolutely. I hope he boogies down to a man's jam.
All right. Okay. Well, as always, please, please send us feedback, questions, and suggestions on Twitter at Nets_Pulse or via email. And we actually have an email address this time. That's to netspulse@gmail.com. There's no punctuation or spacing in between, just netspulse@gmail.com. We will absolutely read and get back to all of your feedback. It's super important to us. This podcast is supposed to be for Nets fans by diehard Nets fans. And I think with that, we should leave you guys with a shout out to Shabazz Napier's rat tail and another reminder that Koskov sucks.
Absolutely. All right. Good night, Canada.
Talk to you later, buddy.
Bye.